بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم تسليما كثيرا. ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. اللهم علمنا ما ينفعنا وانفعنا بما علمتنا وزدنا علما. اللهم افتح علينا بحكمتك وانشر علينا برحمتك يا ذا الجلال والإكرام. وصل اللهم على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله الكرام. ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. I wanted to, before we get into Imam al-Ghazali, I just wanted to start. And are we live streaming? So just salam to all the people, wherever you are around the world. These are the days of miracles and wonders. So we're here in Turkey speaking to people. We were up on the top of the mountain yesterday and we were just looking at this amazing place, and the cell phone rang, somebody who was with us, and hi, Mom. And they were calling from California. So it's just very amazing, all this technology. But I wanted to begin with, just inshallah for some blessing, read you something from Imam al-Shatibi. And Imam al-Shatibi, rahimahullah, is one of the great Usuli scholars of Islamic tradition. He was an Andalusian, and he's very interesting because his two most famous books, one of them is called Al-Atisam, and the other is called Al-Muwafaqat. And if you read them, you will think they're written by two different people because they have very different approaches to a lot of things. But the Muwafaqat is the one I think that is more relied upon in terms of its usuli principles. The I'tisam is a book that has been abridged and has been spread by certain schools that like his approach, because he, in that book, is very harsh about what's called bid'ah or innovation. And he takes a position. Traditionally, the ulama differentiated between different types of bid'ah. And Imam al-Shatibi takes a position in there that he talks about bid'ah haqiqiyah, which is something like praying six prayers a day instead of five. And then what he calls bid'ah idafiyah. And the bid'ah idafiyah is an innovation that part of it is sound because it's got a basis from a dalil, a proof. But there's something that's been added on to it that he considers unacceptable. An example of that would be to do the mawlid, for instance, would be a bid'ah idafiyah, because celebrating the birth of the Prophet ﷺ is a fard ayn. If you're not happy he was born, you're not a Muslim. But the idea of celebrating on a specific day, he would say, was the innovation that was added. Now, the majority of ulama don't agree with that position, but that is his position. And it's a respected position in that it is his position and it's the position of other scholars. But it's not the position of the majority of scholars. And there is a principle in usul that if the scholars disagree on something, that whether it's makruh or mandub, they actually say the ahwat is to consider it mandub, as long as it's not muharram mujma alayh. Nobody can say that that certain things that are done, practiced, are haram unless they have a dalil, a proof that it's haram. You simply just can't say something's haram. In fact, it's the heaviest thing to do in this religion. And if you look at the early community, they did not say this is halal or this is haram, because the Quran actually prohibits you from saying that unless you have a clear proof from God that something is haram. You should not say that that's haram. And that's why Imam Malik radiallahu anhu and the early Imams and Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah in his famous book of Usul called the I'lam al-Muwaqqi'in, he mentions he has a bab in there on the prohibition of calling a fatwa the ruling of God. That you can't call a fatwa. A fatwa is a personal opinion. It's what you think God would have revealed about something, even though you don't know. But it's your ijtihad. So you can't say it's the hukm of God. This is the opinion of Imam Malik about this thing. Abu Hanifa might have a different opinion, and because they're both imams, it's both valid. So a lot of people don't understand the importance of that distinction. So when you look at Imam Shatibi, in the abridged books that a lot of people, they're the only ones they read, a lot of things have been taken out that you find in the larger books if you actually read them. So this is one of them, and I just wanted to start with this, that Imam Shatibi sometimes actually goes against his own principles in his books. And this is common. The ulama are not ma'asumun. They make mistakes. And sometimes it's because it's at a different stage of their own evolution. Because this idea is people say, oh, he's changed. Well, hopefully. That's the whole purpose of life. If you stay the same, you're dead, either spiritually or biologically. Because life is response to stimuli. That's how it's defined biologically. Spiritually, it's response to Allah's creation. So if you're not growing spiritually, then you're dead and decaying. And so the scholars grow themselves. Imam Malik's positions when he was younger are not the same as they were when he was older. One of the blessings of the Shafi'i madhab is that Imam Shafi'i worked out so many of the things. They said, in fact, that it was in a way that he died so young, because Imam Malik lived to be 90. Imam Shafi'i dies in his early 50s. Because he lived so young, there was things left over for other people to do. Like, had he lived a life like Imam Malik's, he would have left nothing for anybody else to do. And so, in the Shafi'i madhab, his opinions are very well formulated and people know what they are. In the Maliki madhab, you have to look at who's saying it. So you have the Ibn Majishun has an opinion of Malik that differs from another student like Ibn al-Qasim. And so the scholars try to work out, well, at which point did he say this? And you will find hadith also like that, because the Prophet ﷺ said one thing at a certain point when he felt that it was acceptable later on for the community. For instance, he initially did not allow them to write the hadith down because he was concerned that they would mix the hadith with the Quran. But once he felt that they would not make that mistake, he then told them to write it down. So you will see hadiths that say, don't write my hadith down. And then you get a group that don't believe in hadith that say, oh, well, look, here's the hadith. He himself said, don't write his hadith down. So why did we write them down? Because he said that at a certain stage. But at a later stage, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said to Abu Huraira, "Ista'in bi yaminika," use your right hand. In other words, write them down. And so they wrote hadith down, and they had sahaif. They were called sahaif. These were the first collections of hadith, like Ibn al-As had a sahifa. Abu Bakr destroyed his sahifa. So we don't have them. We have very few hadiths from Abu Bakr. Because, first of all, he knew that the hadiths were out there from other sahaba, and because he had such wara, or piety and scrupulousness, that didn't want that responsibility. He left it for others to do that. But the point is that scholars have stages, and the tradition has stages also. And so Imam Shatibi is talking about basing dhikr or ta'abbudat on visions. Now, one of the things that certain people argue is that you cannot do any dhikr that was not given directly from the Prophet ﷺ, which is negated by many hadiths where sahaba did their own things. We have du'as from the sahaba that were not from the Prophet ﷺ. And we know that one of the sahaba in a prayer, when the Prophet ﷺ said, "Sami Allahu liman hamida," he said, "Rabbana wa lakal hamd hamdan kathiran tayyiban mubarakan fi." And when he finished, the Prophet ﷺ said, "Who said that?" And they were all silent because they were worried. And then he said, you know, who said that? Because I heard the angels, they were saying that. And so the Sahabi said, I said it, Ya Rasulullah. It was just ilham. And the Prophet aqarrahu. So he thought it was a good thing. He said to Bilal one day, Bilal, what are you doing in your actions? Because I heard, when I was in paradise, I heard the footprints, the footsteps ahead of me. And he knew that was for a reason. So Bilal said, I never have lost my wudu except that I felt Allah had a right upon me to renew it. And I never renewed it except that I prayed 2 rakats. And the Prophet said, Fahuma, that's what did it. That action was from Bilal. It wasn't from the Prophet ﷺ. Bilal did that because it wasn't a bid'ah. Wudu is from the deen, and 2 rakats is from the deen, and you can do those any time. But he put those two together, Bilal. Now some of them would say that is okay for the Sahaba, but people after that can't do it. That's another opinion. Because the Prophet has to agree or yuqirru. But what Ibn Ulubbin and other Usuri scholars argue is that the fact that the Prophet was teaching that was indication that there are things that people will come up with. And we know in the hadith, أَوْ عَلَمْتَ أَحَدًا مِّنْ خَلْقِكَ, about the names of God, or something you taught one of your creation. So he, Imam al-Shatibi says, وَنْظُرْ أَيْضًا مِّنْ هَذَا الْأُسْلُوبِ نَصُّ الشَّاطِبِ. This is the man quoting him, عَلَى جَوَازِهِ أَنُّ الْمُسْتَثْنَى مِّنْ أَصْلٍ مَمْنُوعٍ الاستدلال بالرؤية فقال أخطأ قل كل يوم 40 مرة يا حي يا قيوم لا إله إلا أنت. So Imam al-Shatibi says, قال هذا كلام حسن لا إشكال في صحته. So Imam al-Shatibi says about one of the great scholars, Imam al-Kattani, in this section, he says, using vision as a proof for something. He says, the vision is only for the prophets. And so, you cannot, by sharia, use it as a proof. إِلَّا أَن تَعْرِضَهَا عَلَى مَا فِي أَيْدِينَ مِنَ الْأَحْكَامِ الشَّرْعِيَةِ. Unless you put it in front of the standard of what we already have from the ahkam of the sharia, so from the rulings of the sharia, and if the ahkam al-shar'iyya sawwaghatha, if it deems it acceptable, then one can act according to that vision. Like it's been related from Imam al-Kattani, rahimahullah, that he said, I saw the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and he's an imam, and he's a thiqah in hadith. Like if he relates a hadith, we trust him. So if he says he saw the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, if he's not a liar about the outward knowledges, he's not going to lie about a vision, because to lie about a vision is lying about revelation, because it's a portion of revelation, and that's the greatest sin that you can do. So he said, I saw the Prophet in a dream, and we know, مَنْ رَآنِي فِي الْمَنَامِ فَقَدْ رَآنِي حَقَّ فَإِنَّ الشَّيْطَانَ لَا يَتَصَوَّرُ بِصُورَتِي. Whoever sees me in a dream has seen me in truth, because the devil cannot take my form. And that's also true of the Kaaba. If you see the Kaaba in a dream, it's a true dream. So he says, I said to the Prophet ﷺ, ask Allah that he will not cause my heart to die. And the Prophet said to me, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, say every day, 40 times, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, La Ilaha Illa Anta. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, La Ilaha Illa Anta. So, that's something, if you want to do it, you're free to do it every day, if you can. If you don't want to do it, that's fine too. Because it's not, it's from Imam al-Kattani, but he saw it in a vision from the Prophet ﷺ. So in that way, what Imam Shatibi is saying, this is good. There's no problem, because the Sharia says that you can say, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, La Ilaha Illa Anta. That's a Quranic siga, that you can say that. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum are from the Asma of Allah, muttafaq alayhima. There's no disagreement about them. They're from the names of Allah bil ijma', because they're in the Quran, the Hadith, and it's clear. And then also So in, for instance, in some places, they do that at Fajr. You will hear that done at Fajr. And there are people that do that. So I just wanted to start for the blessing of the names of Allah to do that 40 times for whoever wants to do that. And inshallah, with the niyyah that our hearts don't die. Because hearts, just like they die physically, they also die spiritually. So your state is probably different from when we started, because that's a very strong, those are two of the strongest names, Yahyu, Ya Qayyum. Many of the scholars have mentioned that Yahyu, Ya Qayyum is the Ism al-Azam, that it's the strongest name. Most of them say that it's the divine name Allah, and then in the end, Allahu A'lam, Allah knows best. So, inshallah, what we're going to do tonight before we go into, and I know many of you are familiar with the outline of Imam al-Ghazali's life. I want to talk a little bit about it and look at an outline of his life. Imam al-Ghazali, Sheikh Muhammad bin Muhammad bin Muhammad, al-Tusi, al-Ghazali, al-Mulaqib bin Zain al-Din, Abi Hamid, is probably after the generation of the Sahaba, certainly one of the greatest scholars in the history of Islam, and is by the majority of scholars historically ranked amongst the greatest scholars of Islam. Like every scholar, there has been criticism of Imam al-Ghazali, but there was criticism of Imam Malik, there was criticism of Imam Shafi'i. People considered Imam Shafi'i from the Shia. He was actually accused of being a Shia. They have most of the ulama, even the great muhaddithin, there are people that criticize them. Criticism comes from the fact that humans differ greatly just by their nature. They differ. We have different masharib, different drinking places. People know their drinking place by nature, and that's why in Arabic they say al-tuyur ala ashkariha taqa, that birds tend to find their own kind and ascend or alight upon them. In English we say birds of a feather flock together. It's the same idea. And so people will rarely agree on anything. There's always difference of opinion. It's the nature of just being in the world. We will differ about food. We'll differ about aesthetics. We'll differ about talent. We'll differ about our likes and dislikes in everything from what we eat to what we wear to who we associate with, to what we find beautiful in the opposite sex or the same sex. All of these things are fodder for human differences. It's just the human condition that we differ. And this is part of the divine intent behind creation, to make people different. We're not the same. We differ. And there's also what's called tafawut in Allah's creation. So animals are different. You cannot compare the cockroach to the eagle in its qualities. And yet Imam al-Ghazali argues that the greatness of the creation of the mosquito is no less than the greatness of the elephant. And he said if you could see it with the eye, you would see, because at that time they didn't have microscopes, but he said you would see that the needle of the mosquito is as extraordinary as the snout of the elephant in its creation. So he said everything is cause for marvel, but obviously the elephant is, both of them are mentioned in the Quran, by the way, because they're both, and Allah says that he is not hesitant to use as an analogy the mosquito itself and anything else. And that ayah came down because some of the Quraysh said, why is this Quran talking about ants and bees? And you know, the Arabs thought, you know, this is insignificant things. But they're not insignificant things. And modern people will spend their whole lives in universities studying the bee and literally not consider it a waste of their life. And now we know that, like Einstein said, if the bee goes, we go. Because the bee is pollinating most of our food that we eat. Everything we ate tonight, a lot of that was from the extraordinary work that the bee is doing, busy as a bee. So when the Quran has a chapter called the bee, there's a reason. And the ant is another extraordinary creature. People have spent their entire lives studying the ant and reflecting on the ant. Henry David Thoreau, in his Walden Pond, talks about sitting for hours watching the ants. And he said they would have battles. And he said he really felt that they were no less great than the Trojan War. And he said he was certain that there was the Achilles and Hectors among these ants that the other ants were looking at. He's on our side. So this vast creation that Allah has made is all differences, and humans differ. And there are humans that differ in intelligence, even though intelligence is extraordinarily distributed amongst people. There is quite an equal distribution of intelligence. People, by and large, are intelligent. We do stupid things, all of us. There's nobody, with the exception of the prophets, that are free of doing things that are foolish at times or ridiculous, or it's just human nature, and it's also to humble us. But there's undeniably people that are what is no longer politically correct to say, but what the Arabs call ahmaq. You know, there are stupid people. And hamaqa is a problem in the world. In fact, Marx, the philosopher and founder of communism, Marx considered stupidity to be the fourth most important factor in historical events and change. Just stupidity. People doing stupid things, like going to war in Iraq, was a very stupid thing to do. And it's cost vast amounts of human life and incredible waste, and the repercussions of it will go on for a long, long time. But people do stupid things. But people get elected to the highest offices in countries that are arguably very stupid people, but they got there somehow or another, which is also part of the proof that there's a divine element here, you know, providence. People are meant to be where they are because there's no other way to explain how they got there except that God put them there. And they even often think that that is the case, but for the wrong reasons. Not because they're meant to do something great, but because they're meant to do their stupid things for whatever reasons. So when we look at Imam al-Ghazali, there is some criticism of it, but it is arguably the criticism of a man that Asad ibn al-Furat mentioned, who he saw in Egypt. Asad ibn al-Furat, one of the great scholars of Islam, studied with Imam Malik, and he became a great judge. And Imam Malik, as he was leaving, it's considered one of the kashfs of Imam Malik, his miracles, unveilings. He said to Asad ibn al-Furat, اتَّقِ اللَّهَ فِي هَذِهِ الْأُمَّةِ, and have compassion. Because Asad was going to become a qadi. He didn't know it at the time. But Asad, after studying with Malik, he said he went to Egypt, and he was in a masjid, and this is in the madkhal of Ibn al-Hajj. He was in the masjid, and he saw a man giving a dars, a lecture, and the man said, قَالَ مَالِكٌ كَذَا وَكَذَا وَقَدْ أَخْطَأَ وَصَوَابُ كَذَا وَكَذَا قَالَ مَالِكٌ وَقَدْ أَخْطَأَ وَصَوَابُ كَذَا وَكَذَا. Malik said, and he made a mistake, and here's the accurate opinion. And he kept going on, criticizing Malik. And Asad ibn al-Furat said, I looked at that man, and I likened him to a man who came to a vast ocean, the shore of a vast ocean, and urinated a little puddle, and said, here's another ocean. So this is something that humans do. They, from their pathetic little positions, they will attack these mountains. And nobody remembers that Egyptian guy in that mosque. His name isn't even mentioned in the story. He's long gone, but Imam Malik's teachings are still being taught here today and all over the world. And Imam al-Ghazali is like that. He's a mountain. He's a giant. And the more you know about him, the bigger the mountain gets. Because mountains from a distance, if you look at this mountain here from a distance, it will appear very small. But the closer you get to it, the bigger it gets. And then when you start to ascend it, the more sapped of energy you become. And by the time, if you could ever get to the top, you're panting and completely exhausted and out of breath. One of Imam Ghazali's students said about him, nobody can understand his fadl, his virtue, unless he had kana kamal al-aql, unless he had really excellent intellect. Imam Masuki said about that, he said, وَهَذَا فَهْمٌ صَحِيحٌ. He said, this is a sound understanding, because a man can only be judged by intellect and understanding. He said, بِالْعَقْل يُمَيِّز وَبِالْفَهْم يَقْضِي. With the intellect you can distinguish, but it's the understanding that you're able to judge. So the intellect can see that this person is intelligent, knows what they're talking about, but it's the understanding that enables you to really assess it at a deeper level. And Imam Tajuddin al-Subki says, the reality of it is, no one can understand the qadr of Imam al-Ghazali, because there has not been anyone like Imam al-Ghazali since Imam al-Ghazali. And Imad al-Din al-Hanbali, one of the great scholars, said about Imam al-Ghazali, لَمْ يَرَى al-Ghazali أَحَدًا مِثْلَ نَفْسِهِ. He never saw anybody that was like him. In other words, all the great scholars that he studied with, he surpassed them all, including the greatest of his teachers in the outward sciences, Imam al-Juwayni. Imam al-Juwayni said about him, هو بحر مغبق. الرواية says مغرق. You know, he was a vast ocean, or he was an ocean to drown in. When you look at Imam al-Ghazali, the first thing about him, and we were talking about this yesterday with one of the people here, he mentioned a book called The Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. And he was talking about how Malcolm Gladwell discusses the nature of circumstance and how important circumstance is in the success of people. People, we have a fantasy in the West of attributing success to a type of individual, the triumph of the individual, the person struggling against odds and overcoming great odds like poverty and things like that to rise up. And this is really a fantasy, because what makes a human being, there are so many variables. So for instance, he uses Bill Gates as an example. Bill Gates, when he was 17 years old, happened to go to a school that was already working with computers when nobody was working with computers. He was from a wealthy family. But he had access to a mainframe that nobody had access to at that time, unless you were in a very specialized field. And this was in the 60s. And he would go at 2 in the morning, sneak out of his house and go to this place, and he would do his programming on this as a 17-year-old. And that, he could have been a genius born in Watts and never had that afforded to him, that opportunity. Also, if you look at those people who became all these heads of these, like Oracle and Microsoft and Apple, they were all born in either 1957 or 1958. They were all born in the same year. So the fact that they were born in that year, because that, by the time they were coming of age, was the absolute perfect time to be in that position. So had it not been that, they would have never created these great companies and had all the opportunities that they had. So there would be no Microsoft today had he been born in 1954 or had he been born in 1964. So those aspects of life are very strange. But we would add to that, the Muslims, the metaphysical element that is the unseen element that people often don't consider. Imam al-Ghazali's father was a very simple man. He was a weaver, and he basically would weave things, ghazala. Some say that's where he's called Ghazali because his father was al-Ghazal, the weaver. There's a riwaya on him that he said, people call me Ghazali, but I'm not. I'm Ghazali, because he was from Ghazala, which was a small town outside of Tus. So, but there's still a khilaf because that riwaya is debated among some people. So, but he's generally called al-Ghazali with a soft zay. So his father loved the ulama, and he wished he was an alim, but he did not have the opportunity because he had to go into trade when he was young to support his family. So he didn't have the opportunity to do that, but he loved the ulama. So he would give whatever extra money he earned to the ulama, and he would always sit in their majalis, and he loved them. And he would يتقرب إلى الله بالتقرب إلى العلماء. So when his sons were very young, and when he was about to die, he had a friend who was in the narrations. Imam al-Ghazali himself says he was a Sufi, which would have meant at that time somebody who was devoted to God. So they were usually poor people. But their practice was devotion, and they would spend as little time as possible in the world just to get their basic livelihood. The rest of their life was spent to devotion. He left some money with this man, the little that he had, and he said, because the mother wasn't there, he said, take care of these two boys, the two sons, Abu Hamid Muhammad and his brother Ahmed. And Imam al-Ghazali and his brother Ahmed, who becomes a great scholar as well, and a great wild. He was noted for his incredible sermons, and he was also a poet of some merit. He says that when the money ran out, this man didn't have any money to take care of them, but he did what he could. He said, I suggest that we put you in a madrasa, because you're students of knowledge, and at least you'll get your daily bread. And so they went to a madrasa, and at that time, and this is another aspect, you see, because Imam al-Ghazali, with all his genius, could have been born in a completely different place, but he happened to have been born in a place that had some of the greatest scholars of that age. So he was born in a place where even at his primary education, he is getting excellent training. So he goes into the school, and he will say later, تَعْلَمْتُ الْعِلْمَ لِغَيْرِ اللَّهِ فَأَبَى الْعِلْمُ إِلَّا أَنْ يَكُونَ لِلَّهِ. We learn knowledge for other than the sake of Allah, because we were in the madrasa to get some food. But knowledge refused to be other than for the sake of Allah. So he was in this madrasa, and his first teacher, Sheikh al-Radhkali, was a faqih and taught him the basics of, he would have memorized the Quran, he would have learned Shafi'i fiqh. In that area there were Shafi'is and Hanafis. The Shafi'i madhab, like the Maliki madhab, was in many areas that die out later, because the ruling houses, depending on whatever madhab they adopted, you would get movements from those madhabs. There was a study at Harvard done, they had a conference where they studied the madhab proliferation, and in the very early period of madhabs, the Maliki madhab was by far the dominant madhab. But what happens, and Maliki madhab was in India, it was in Afghanistan, it was in Khorasan, Baghdad, it was all over. And most of the Arabian Peninsula was Maliki, including the Najd. But as the endowments, because of the adaptation of the Hanafi madhab by the ruling Abbasid, the endowments, you begin to see these migrations into the Hanafi madhab. And this is why the ulama actually talk about moving to another madhab to get an endowment, and whether it was permissible or not. Sidi Abdullah ibn Hajj Ibrahim doesn't deem it something that was acceptable. But that was something that happened. The Shafi'i madhab was like that. It eventually gets overtaken by the Hanafis, and the Hanafis were quite severe at certain times with the Shafi'is. In fact, Imam al-Juwayni had to flee from the Khurasan and goes to Mecca and Medina, and that's why he's called Imam al-Haramain, because he taught in Mecca and Medina before he went back. But Imam al-Ghazali, radiallahu anhu, studies first with this, and then he goes and studies in Naysabur with another scholar who is Abu Mansur al-Ismaili, and he spends 2 years doing what he called ta'liqa. So he's taking all these notes and writing these books from hearing all the lectures. On the way back to Tuz, he tells us that the caravan is actually some brigands basically take hostage this caravan, and they steal everything, including what was called his mikhla. You know, the ulama had something they called the mikhla. The mikhla is actually the feeding bag that you put on a horse. But for the ulama, the mikhla was what they carried their knowledge in, because they were always feeding from it. And so he had his mikhla, and in it were his books. And they took that amongst the books. Imam al-Ghazali says, I followed them. And they turn and look at him and said, Wayhak. You know, ibta'id aw tahlik, you know, woe to you, if you keep coming, we're going to kill you. And he said, I ask you by the one that you all hope salama from, that you hope safety from, meaning God, to give me back my ta'liqa. And they said, what, the muqaddim of them, the head thief, says, what is that? He said, it's in that mikhla. He said, it's my books, I just spent 2 years putting this all down, and that's my knowledge. And Imam al-Ghazali says he laughed at that point, this brigand. He said, that's your knowledge? He said, what kind of knowledge do you have if the likes of me could steal it from you? And then you no longer have any knowledge? And Imam al-Ghazali says, هذا مستنطقون أنطقه الله سبحانه وتعالى. This man I knew at that point, Allah had told him, had made him say that to me so that I would know that I had not acquired that knowledge. And he goes back to Tuz and spends 3 years putting to rote memory everything that he had written down. 3 years he spent. He had a prodigious memory, and then he goes and studies after that with Imam al-Juwayni. He's a young man, 19 years old. And Imam al-Juwayni was an absolute genius, a mujaddid really in usul. He's one of the great Shafi'i scholars. He's a master of fiqh, he's a master of kalam, he's a master of usul. And he recognizes immediately the brilliance of Imam al-Ghazali and takes him and mentors him. Imam al-Ghazali, during this period, is mastering the sciences of his time. He learns, of course, he was a master of the Arabic language and the Quran. These are the foundational knowledges in that traditional world. But he masters mantiq, he masters khilaf, ilm al-khilaf, he masters bahth wa munadhara, disputation and argumentation, because there were rules to arguing. Like now, people just argue without any rules, but traditionally they actually had rules. Like, for instance, if you mention any word in the rules of argumentation, you have to be able to define it. So if we're talking and you say something, I say, well, define that term. If you couldn't define the term, the argument's over. Right? So he learned all of these sciences and mastered them. By the time he is 27 years old, Imam al-Juwayni dies. By the time he's 27 years old, he's finished his formal studies. He is absolutely undefeatable in debate. He was also one of the most articulate people in both Persian and Arabic. when you hear not only the syntax but the eloquence of his language is really quite stunning. And people were mesmerized by him. When he spoke, they were in awe, complete awe of him. And it's hard for us to imagine this, but you have to realize that this was a time when you had great scholars, people that just knew so much, and much of it by rote memorization. Ibn Khaldun, who is not considered one of the great Maliki scholars, he's a Maliki, he was a Qadi, and he was the head of the Maliki Qadis in Egypt after he fled Tunisia. Imam Ibn Khaldun memorized by rote the Mudawwana of Imam Sahnun in the Maliki Madhab, which is now in today's small print edition, it's about 6 volumes. I mean, literally thousands of pages, by rote, could quote. This was a time of immense memory development. They had techniques that they learned. A lot of the memory development has diminished in our society because we have iPods and iPhones, and people don't need memory anymore like they used to. And also books. We have books now, and we can look things up. In those days, books were not as available, readily available as they are today. So they had massive rote memorization, and he could beat everybody. And he became incredibly arrogant. And he admits this, and that's one of the beauties of Imam al-Ghazali, is that he is incredibly honest. And he is full of himself. He is a complete egoist. He relished debates. And he loved to squelch opponents. And he basically then, like the ulama of that time, he said, it's time to go to the Sultan. And so he sets out for the Mukhayyam of Nizam al-Mulk, who is the greatest wazir of the Seljuk Turks. And all the ulama in Nizam al-Mulk's majlis are there, and Imam al-Ghazali shows up, and before you know it, they're all saying, he's better than any of us. Nizam al-Mulk pulls him in, and he spends some time, and he's lavished upon. This was a time when scholarship was honored in the Muslim world. I mean, it is still to a certain degree, but nothing like that time. In those days, you could become incredibly wealthy. In the same way that in the West, it's more like the Christian, some of these tele-evangelists and things like that, that become multimillionaires. It was like that they could literally become multimillionaires. Imam al-Ghazali is lavished upon, and then Nizam al-Mulk, they're living in a time when there was a lot of problems. The Ismailis had taken over Egypt in the Fatimid period. And so they were they had a lot of missionary work. And the Azhar University was founded as a missionary school to train what were called the da'is, or the du'at, of the Ismailiyya, Batiniyya tradition. It was an esoteric tradition. And they were very clever. And Imam al-Ghazali benefits from the Ismailis, because he masters their madhab, and they had some very clever interpretative tools that he will use, but not in the same way that they use them, because they rejected the outward meanings. They thought the outward meaning was for fools, and that the only real meaning was the esoteric meaning. But so the Ismailis are there, and they have their influence. They had assassins. The Hashashin were a sect, like they were in the same way that you have certain terrorist groups that break off from today, and they'll go and assassinate. The Ismailis were also, the assassins were like, you had the, in Waco, Texas, you had that Seventh-day Adventist cult. That doesn't represent the Seventh-day Adventist. In the same way, the Hashashin, the assassins, were not really part of the Ismaili, even though they came out of that. It was a heresy from within their own tradition. But they were there, and they were killing people. It's said that Nizam al-Mulk himself was assassinated by an Ismaili assassin. And the word we have in English, assassin, which Shakespeare introduces into our language, is taken from Hashashin. So The Imam al-Ghazali is Nizam al-Mulk in his genius, and he was a scholar himself. He recognized that one of the fundamental problems was that with all of the sectarianism, you could not have a unified population. And for governments that want social order, to have conformity is very important. And he really saw that what was needed was to have a normative tradition. And so he set up a series of schools called the Nizamiya. And the great one is in Baghdad, but there were several. And he appoints Imam al-Ghazali the head of the Nizamiya, a lecturer. He becomes the head lecturer, but he's only 34 years old. I mean, this is like a youth to the older scholars. Because it would take till you were 40 to really become a master of a lot of these things. But he had already done all this in his 20s. So he goes to Baghdad. One of the scholars there who knew him well said that when he came to Baghdad, they said that we reckon قَيَّمْنَا مَلْبُوسَهُ وَمَرْكَبُهُ عَلَى 500 دِنَارٍ. We figured that his clothes and then his carriage or his horse or whatever he was using for his vehicle, it was around 500 dinars. It was an immense amount of money, gold dinars. What they were saying was he came in as a sultan. And very shortly, he has a majlis in which 400 turbaned ulama were in there taking lessons from him. This is Baghdad, the center of the Islamic world. And Imam al-Ghazali, at 34, is having his majlis filled with seasoned scholars. And he's teaching everything. And they sit there mesmerized by his language, by his charisma, by his ability to answer any question put to him. The speed of his intellect was just beyond belief. And this goes on for a few years. And he's getting more and more famous. He said, I had wealth, shuhra. I had fame. I had maal. I had wealth. I had jah. I had stature. And he loved the stature. He loved it. He thrived on it. And he said that one of the ministers who knew him in Baghdad, when he met him much later after he'd gone on his seclusion for 11 years, he met him and Imam al-Ghazali said to him, because you're a minister, I think your time would be better spent in the ministry than sitting with me. And the man left and he wrote about that meeting. He said, subhanAllah, he said, this is a man who used to come to me seeking new titles to his already existing titles, like academic titles. And he said, and now, look at his state. He was amazed at the transformation. But Imam al-Ghazali, at about 37, he has a crisis. First of all, he goes through an extraordinary skeptic period where he has a lot of skepticism. And this is preceded by an incredible intellectual output. Dr. Ormsby says that as far as he can tell, and he did his PhD on al-Ghazali, and he's very well versed in the Western tradition, he said he knows of no scholar in human history, with the possible exception of Kierkegaard, that has, and I wouldn't compare the two in that way, although Kierkegaard is certainly a great philosopher and theologian, but and his output was immense. But what he says is he knows of no scholar that has this output. There's differences about how many books he wrote. Ibn Khaldikan and others say, Zarqali says it's about 200 books. His three most influential works are Munqidh min al-Dalal, which he wrote very late, and it's his short autobiography, which everybody should read if you're able to. It's translated by Mukhtar Holland. It's a very nice translation, and it's readily available. You really, if you have not read that, I would really, really recommend sitting down and reading it, because it's one of the most powerful books that I think you'll ever read. And then the second book would be a Tahafut al-Falasifa, which is a little difficult to translate. Tahafut can mean different things, but it's usually translated as the incoherence of the philosophers. And in that book, which he wrote before his crisis, he wrote two great books on philosophy, Maqasid al-Falasifa. And in this book, Maqasid al-Falasifa, he basically lays down the aims and intents of the philosophers. And the scholars were actually very disturbed by this book and argued that he did a great disservice, because he made their ideas so clear that it became accessible to even common people. And so they actually argued that the book was problematic from that, because he had a genius of explaining things in very simple terms, very complex things. And that can only come from somebody who has a great understanding of something, to be able to explain it in and make it plain. So he writes Tahafut al-Falasifa, and then his opus, magnus opus, which is the Ihya Ulum al-Din, the reviving the sciences of the deen, the religion. And these are his three most influential books. But the reality of it is, he during this period, he writes Mizan al-Amal, which is a masterpiece in philosophical ethics. He was a master and memorized by rote Al-Dhari'atu ila Makarim al-Shari'ah by Raghib al-Isfahani, which is one of the greatest books on philosophical ethics ever written. I've read enough books in ethics to really feel that I could say something like that, because I know the foundational books of ethics. I mean, not well, but I've read them. And his book is just a stunning book on ethics. Imam al-Ghazali was heavily indebted to Raghib al-Isfahani. And that book has also been translated into English, by the way. It's an amazing book. It's a book that I've read several times, and it's really one of my favorite books. And it was one of his favorite books, so it's nice to have a favorite book that was one of his favorite books. And then he wrote Mizan al-Ilm, which is a book on logic. He wrote Al-Qistas al-Mustaqim, another book on Quranic logic, proving that the Quran uses enthymemes and syllogisms, because at that time some of the ulama argued that logic was unacceptable. So he shows that in fact logic is a useful tool, but certainly not the end all. And there are things that transcend logic, but it was a useful tool for reasoning purposes. He wrote several books in Usul. His most famous, his two books of Usul, the two books that all the Usuli scholars refer to, is Al-Mankhul and Al-Mustasfa. Al-Mankhul is a book in an earlier period, and he matures quite a bit. So the Mustasfa is considered his great Usuli work. And I'll say this about him as an Usuli, and this is really important to understand. He is a Mujaddid in Usul. Imam al-Ghazali, people think of him as a Sufi. It is arguable that he is first and foremost an Usuli scholar before he's anything else. And his really great contribution to Islamic tradition is in the Mustasfa, is in Usul. And I asked Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayya, and I mentioned this to some of you who were there, I asked Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayya, if he was on a desert island and he could only take one Usuli book, what would it be? And he said, the Mustasfa of Imam al-Ghazali. And that's a man who spent his life studying the great books of Usul. So it's not a statement to be taken lightly. He was also a master of ilm al-Kalam. He wrote his Al-I'tiqad, Al-Iqtisad fi Al-I'tiqad, Al-Risala Al-Qudsiyya. He also wrote Il-Jam' al-Awam. His last book is a book really arguing that common people should not study dialectical theology because it was confusing and dangerous for them. So he definitely saw that scholarship is something. He felt that certain sciences should be left to a certain cadre of intellectuals, and he was very concerned about that. He argues in many places that that it's very dangerous when common people begin to delve into these things without the necessary training. And this is one of the profound problems of religion. And that is that Sidi al-Mawaq, one of the great Maliki jurists and Usuli scholars, says that it's actually far less harmful for a person to fornicate and steal than it is for them to speak about God or revelation without knowledge. And yet people do it very lightly. Go on the internet, it's filled with great mushtahidun and ulama that criticize this, that, or the other, and this hadith is fabricated, even though it's an authenticated hadith in Sahih Muslim or al-Bukhari, but they say it's fabricated because it doesn't make sense to them. But this is one of the great dangers, and he was very aware of that. And then, so during that point, he writes all this, and it all comes out, and then he's really collapsed. He's in probably physical and mental exhaustion, and he has this crisis, and it's initially a crisis of doubt, but it's self-doubt, because what he feels is that he's inauthentic. What he realized, and at this point, even though he was raised in a milieu of spirituality, he is raised in a milieu of tasawwuf. One of his teachers, Al-Farmadi, was a student of Imam Al-Qushayri, who wrote the Risala, great Ash'ari mutakallim and a great Sufi. So he was exposed to all these books, but he began to read these books seriously. Qut al-Qulub, Abu Talib al-Makki has great influence on him. The books of Imam al-Muhasibi. He's reading these books, and what he's saying is, I realize, he says, أَدْرَكْتُ أَنَّ هَؤُلَاءِ أَرْبَابَ الْأَحْوَالِ لَا أَصْحَابَ الْأَقْوَالِ. I realize that these people were people of states. They weren't people of words. And what he was feeling increasingly, that he was a person of words. There was nothing happening to him. His inner state was it was numb, and he would speak and it didn't mean anything to him, and the clapping was getting old, it wasn't having the high of, oh, great dars imam, Allahu Akbar, you're badi'u zaman, man of the age. That it wasn't happening for him anymore. That wasn't. And this is moving into maturity. He's 37. He's getting close to 40. 40 is a big age, and people died, as they still do. But obviously, they didn't have 9/11. If you live in America or something, where you get a ambulance, and so people have this illusion that we've got the defibrillators and things, and people can come back from the dead today. In those days, if you got sick, you either got well or you died. And medicine was really kind of like placebo and barakah in a lot of cases. Ruqya was far more effective than a lot of the medicines that they were taking. And if you could get somebody who was good at a ruqya, then it really helped. They said Imam Sahnoun, when he gave a ruqya, if he did the Fatiha, he would, put the spittle, and they would get up immediately. You can only take money for ruqya if they get well immediately, by Sharia in the Maliki method. So you can take, if somebody gets up well immediately, you can take money. But if not, you can't, because they're just getting well out of normal process. This resolution, and he said, Allah, this certainty came into his heart. He had a certainty about things. His skepticism, although he remains a skeptic. But he's a healthy skeptic. Because he tests everything. And he says in a beautiful passage, he says, I never heard a esotericist, but I delved to the depths of his esotericism to understand it. I never heard a theologian, except I delved to the depths of his theology to understand it. I never heard an usuli, except that I delved to the depths of his proofs. He went to the to the depths of whatever he was studying. That was the type of intellect that he had. And he was a lifelong learner. He never wasted any time. He learned philosophy in 2 years in his spare time during the busiest period of his teaching. And he said, I learned it with no teacher. So he mastered all these books. He read everything, Aristotle, Ibn Sina, Al-Kindi, Al-Farabi, and he learned them all. And that was in his spare time, with family, children, and his teaching, as well as all the official visits and things like that that he would have had to have dealt with. So this is a man who wasted no time in his life. His incredible respect for time. And then the barakah, the blessing of the time of the salihin. He then, though, realizes, because he looks at the paths, and he talks about the four paths in the Ihya. There's the paths of the dialectical theologian, the paths of the philosophers, the path of the botany, the esotericists, and then the path of the Sufia. These are the four paths of truth, the pursuit of truth. Now, when we say philosophy, it's important that you understand that for him, philosophy meant six things. Unlike today, we use philosophy today, we're generally talking about a history that begins with the pre-Socratics in Greece and ends with the positivists or the, you know, linguistic analyses, Wittgenstein, and now postmodernist Foucault and Rorty and people like that. That's philosophy in the West. At that time, philosophy was mathematics. Went under the riyadiyat, went under the category of philosophy, mantiq, logic, which is still considered part a branch of philosophy. Natural science was part of philosophy, and then also politics was part of philosophy. What we call ulum siyasiya today, political science, was actually a branch of philosophy, and it still is considered a branch of philosophy. But people don't think of it. Most students would not think of it in that way, but it still goes into that category. And then akhlaq, which is ethics, and then metaphysics. So this to him, this was philosophy. So he included in this empirical sciences, empiricists that believe, like Dawkins is a philosopher. He's an empirical scientist, and he is creating views of the world that are based upon material sciences. And Dawkins is arguing that there's no God, and he's arguing from material sciences. And what he's saying is that even though we haven't fully explained everything in the universe, give us time. Have faith in us. Really, that's essentially what he's saying. He's saying we don't know how the universe began, but we'll find out, just like we found out how life began on Earth. It began with a lightning bolt that struck a pond of water and began this whole process and these cells that developed out of that and then turned into all the various creatures that you had, and it was a long process of cause and effect, and you had natural selection, all these incredibly random events. Where things would die off because they couldn't survive, and you have the survival of the fittest, and so there's no real design. Design is just a trick. So don't think that you're designed. You just don't understand natural selection. You're not designed. You just happen to be the fittest to survive. So he would argue that that's true of the universe. And a lot of what they say is, for instance, they will say that, well, we don't know that there's not parallel universes. This could have been born out of another universe. So one of Dr. Winter's aphorisms, what does he call them? Contentions. One of his contentions is multiple universes is the last refuge of the atheist. Right? So he would see that is an attempt to find the truth. The dialectical theologians proving the existence of God with the cosmological Kalam argument, you can't have an actual infinity. You can't have an actual infinity, and therefore there had to have been a first cause. There had to have been a beginning, and that first cause had to have been wajib al-wujub, necessarily existent, because the universe is only contingently existence. Accidents inhere in essences, and the accidents can't exist without the essence, and the accidents are changeable. Therefore, change is part of the universe. Change has no permanence. Therefore, the universe isn't permanent. So it can't be God, and it can't have created itself. لَوْ أَحْدَثَتْ لِنَفْسِيَ الْأَكْوَانُ لِاسْتَمَعَتْ تَسَوِّ الرِّجْحَانُ. If the universe made itself, then that would have meant that preponderance and equilibrium would have been equal, and that's the joining of two opposites, and that's impossible. You can't join two opposites. These are the arguments of the dialectical theologians. Imam al-Ghazali mastered them and said, I'm sorry, they don't lead to truth. They don't. I'm not satisfied. We'll teach them. They're useful. But they're not going to give you that inner peace about God. And you can understand them and still not believe, like many people that teach these things in universities. And then he says the Batini people, they argue that there's this esoteric knowledge that's only available to a few people. And you just have to trust us. We're the special ones that have this knowledge, and just follow us and give us money usually, and we'll make sure that you're blessed and part of this group, and you'll get saved. And he writes a book against them, the Mustadharif, about the Ismaili heresy, and argues that again it's not a path to the truth for him. And then he looks at the philosophers and concludes that they have 20 mistakes. 17 of them are bid'ah, and they're not really cause for kufr, but 3 of them are cause for kufr, and he delineates those. They say God knows universals, doesn't know particulars, rubbish. And if you believe that, you're a kafir. They say that the body can't be resurrected, like a bodily resurrection. And then they say that the universe is eternal, coexistent and eternal with God. So he rejects all of those. And that's all delineated in Tahafut al-Falasifa. But then he says, I looked at the Sufiyya and I realized that their path was the path of truth. He has this realization and it's firm in his heart. And so he sits there for 6 months and he's saying, it's so easy for me to read their books, because he's an intellectual and he loves reading. You know, just sit there, read Qut al-Qulub, but I'm not going to do any of this stuff, right? I'll just read about it. But then he realizes it's reading about it is not going to do it. It's not going to get me anywhere, because it's all up here. And he says this path is a path of suluk and dhawq. It's a path of practice, discipline, practice, and experience. And he uses dhawq. He's very interested in the senses. And he uses the senses as metaphors. But dhawq becomes his central metaphor, the idea of taste. He talks about one man who writes to this scholar to ask him, and he uses a lot of sexual analogies. And Dr. Winter talked about that, and the importance of that, and the centrality of that. Even in the Quranic vision, it's an important part. But he uses these sexual analogies, and he talks about the man who writes to the scholar and asks him to explain to him the delight of sexual intercourse. So he writes, Imam al-Ghazali says that he writes back saying, "I knew that you were impotent," you know, because the man couldn't. He wanted to understand it, but he couldn't experience it. He said, "I knew you were impotent, but I didn't know you're an idiot as well, because this is dhawq. You cannot explain to somebody what honey tastes like. Well, it's like sugar. No, it's not like sugar. Right? Well, it's like molasses. Okay, it has the viscosity of molasses, but it's not like molasses. The only way that you can explain to somebody what honey tastes like is getting a spoon out and giving them a taste of honey." And what he is saying is, the only way that you can truly experience this reality is to taste it. If you want to know God, you have to taste knowledge of God. It's not something you can learn with your heads. It's not something that you can learn in a textbook or read about. It is an experience. But then he argues to himself, these people, these Sufis, they are claiming if you do this, if you take this path, you will get these results. Here's the problem for him. This is a man who is a great scientist. And what he is saying is, these people are arguing that this is experimental science. If you have a hypothesis, you test the hypothesis. It is scientific if you can replicate, right? If we say that ice freezes at 0 degrees Celsius or 32 degrees Fahrenheit, we test it. This is called falsifiability, Karl Popper's idea. You test it, and sure enough, every time we freeze to 0 degrees Celsius, the water freezes, the molecules freeze. Therefore, we can say water freezes at 0 Celsius. What he's saying is, they're saying, if you do this suluk, if you get up at night, if you do this work, if you purify your heart, if you do mujahada, وَالَّذِينَ جَهَدُوا فِينَا لَنَهْدِيَنَّهُمْ سُبَلَنَا, those who struggle for our sake, we will lead them to the paths of our guidance. This is what the Quran is saying. It is experiential. And the suluk is practice. It's doing things on a daily basis. The Prophet ﷺ did things on a daily basis. And he taught people to do these things. Now, Dr. Winter talked about one of the beauties of the religion is the fard, to protect you from ostentation, because everybody does it. So the basic spiritual practice of the Muslims is the fard. And you can draw near to God with nothing greater than the fard. But then there's the nawafil. And it's the nawafil that you become a wali of God. A sanctified wali, because every believer is a wali, but a sanctified wali. And this is the path of sanctification. And this is what Imam Al-Ghazali is saying. Look, at the essence of this teaching is sanctification. This is not simply about salvation. Salvation is part of Islam. And if that's where you want to go, it's an acceptable path. Like the Bedouin who said to the Prophet ﷺ, I heard that if I do say La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah, pray 5 times a day, fast Ramadan, pay my zakat, make hajj, if I do those 5 things, I'll go to Jannah. Is that true? Na'am. He said, Wallahi, that's all I'm going to do, and I won't do a thing more. And he left. And the Prophet ﷺ said, قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الرَّوَيْجُ إِنْ صَدَقْ. That little man, and you know, there's a meaning in that, of using that tasghir. It can be for ta'zeem, because to be successful is ta'zeem, but it can also be his himmah is not very high, his aspiration. But the Prophet said, that man is successful if he's truthful in his oath. That's all he's going to do. That's the path of salvation. That's not the path of Imam Ali. That's not the path of Sayyidina Abu Bakr. No. And that's not the path of the majority of Sahaba that were around the Prophet ﷺ. Their path was the path of sanctification. They were people that were قَدَّسَ اللَّهُ سِرُّهُ. That's the way the ulama traditionally said it. May Allah sanctify his secret. These were people of Quds. They were holy people, muqaddas. Allah is al-Qaddus, the one that makes things holy. Al-Bayt al-Maqdas. If he can make a house holy, you don't think he can make a heart holy? Because we know that the Kaaba, with all its holiness, it's muqaddas. We know that the heart of the believer is more exalted and honored in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's sight than the house. And it's a greater sin to kill a believing heart and take it out of this world than to destroy the Kaaba hajaran hajaran, stone by stone. So if Allah can sanctify stones, he can't sanctify living hearts that testify to his unity and love him? That's what Imam al-Ghazali is saying, that he knew he had to set out. There were two things. The Prophet ﷺ said, مَا ذِئْبَانِ جَائِعَانِ بِأَضَرُّ عَلَىٰ دِينَ الْمَرْءِ عَفْوًا الْمَالُ وَالْجَاهُ الضر على دين المرء من ذئبين جائعين في غنم, that a wealth and stature are more harmful for the religion of a man than two hungry wolves in the midst of shepherdless sheep. And what is Imam al-Ghazali if not a stature seeker? Jah, wajaha. That's what it was all about for him. And also he was doing very well financially. He had wonderful job, beautiful family. And he so every day he says in his munqid, he said, I would put one foot forward to set out on this path, and then I'd put the other one back. I couldn't do it. And then Shaitan would come and say, this is just ardun za'ib, this is just something that will pass. Just let it pass. Let it go. And he would think, no, I'm doing good things, and this is important. And then he said, finally, Allah decided the matter for him. He couldn't speak. Literally goes to class, and he's looking at all these, he's got 300 students in his class, and he can't talk. He literally could not talk. He said his tongue refused to obey him. And he just sat there like an idiot. And these people are looking for him, waiting for the great imam to start pontificating and giving us all his pearls of wisdom. He couldn't do it. He was completely devastated. And he goes home and he's bewildered. The doctors come, take his pulse, examine his urine, do all these things. You know, some say, it's the black bile has taken over. You know, Saudawi is a melancholic. It's too much black bile. He's melancholic. Some say, no. And finally, he's told, this is not a disease of the body. This is a disease of the heart, and we're doctors of the body, and we can't really help you. So there he is, unable to speak. And he realizes what he has to do. And what he does is so radical, and you have to recognize the greatness of this. He basically leaves everything, and he sets his family in order. And I am sure that his wife, because one of his biographers really criticizes him for just kind of abandoning his wife, but undoubtedly, his wife must have been an incredibly pious woman, and she would have been, I think, very much supportive of his need to do this, because that's what love is. And he was definitely a very loving person. And his children were probably older, but he left them in a good condition, and he said, I have to go. And he sets out for Hajj. And he basically tells him he's just going on Hajj. He goes on Hajj, but then he goes to Damascus. And for the next 10 years, he is in complete seclusion. He's not teaching. He's not speaking to people. He's doing dhikr. He's doing fikr. And he's writing the Ihya Ulum al-Din. And this is an incredible period for him. He gives up everything. He sweeps the mosque in Damascus. He lives in the minaret. There's a room there still. I think Imam Zayd's visited it. There's a room there, which is the Ghazali room, where he was in retreat for that time. He goes to Jerusalem. He writes books. And after this 10 years, he then goes back. He remains in Khalwa for 11 years. And then he comes back. This is a completely transformed human being. Everybody recognizes it. All the outward brilliance is interiorized. And suddenly he doesn't even have to speak, because people just sitting in his company are just so overwhelmed. He doesn't have to speak anymore. Qadi Abu Bakr ibn al-Arabi, who's one of the greatest Andalusian scholars, he visited him in Baghdad, and he's one of the last students that he took in Baghdad. In fact, I think he is considered the last student. But he set out to visit him, and he said, he was in seclusion at the time, and he came in, and he said, when I walked into the room, he said, it was as if I had been in darkness my entire life. and I saw the sun rise before my eyes, looking on Imam al-Ghazali. And he said everything was clear to him. And he wrote a great book, Siraj al-Muridin. He's a great scholar of the inward and outward sciences. But this is the impact that the man has. And at the end of his life, he goes back to Tus, and he's convinced to go back to the Nizamiya. He teaches for a few years. And then he retires to his little zawiya he has. And he has just his murids. And that's all he does. And at the age of 54, on December 18th, he, and this is the 900th anniversary, it was 11-11. It's 504 in our Hijrah period. He basically gets his kafan out, and he takes a ghusl, he puts his kafan by his bed, and then he writes a poem to his brother, Ahmed, puts it under the pillow, and he dies. And the poem said that if you see this body, don't weep, because this is not me. This is a cage that the bird of my soul has occupied for a short time, and now it's free. And he is basically Hujjat al-Islam, because his life is the proof of the transformative power of this spiritual teaching. And all of that knowledge, that outward knowledge, which has been a hallmark of the Islamic civilization, to Imam al-Ghazali, meant nothing in the end, in the light of ma'rifah of Allah, of knowing his Lord in his heart. And what he is saying in the Ihya, again and again and again, is he is saying, your death is it's right there. What are you waiting for? Don't waste your life. Don't waste your time. Set out on this journey. Even if you don't arrive, the setting out is arrival. If you're knocking at the door, the knocking is the opening of the door. That's what he's telling us. And the truths that he speaks are as relevant today as they were the day he spoke them and wrote them. And he speaks across centuries. His autobiography is read by Christians, and it affects them as powerfully as it does Muslims. He influences St. Thomas Aquinas. He has an impact on Western civilization that they still have not recognized. And he will continue, as long as Islam is taught, he will continue to be Hujjat al-Islam. That's what he is. And so we're here, inshallah, for these days, these short days, just to honor him in this 900th anniversary by the solar calendar of his death. And the teachings that he left behind that really need to be taught and practiced. And, you know, for me, it's very difficult to read him. A lot of times I always feel in some ways horrible after reading him, because he's just, he doesn't let up. And he doesn't let up in the same way that coaches are often hardest on the people they love the most, and he loves humanity He is writing out of love, this incredible, immense love, and a desire really to see people flourish as human beings, but and also to recognize that this life that we have, it's an incredible opportunity to draw near to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So that's, inshallah, just an introduction. I'm sure some of you know the story quite well and have heard it, but we're going to look at some of his ideas about reading the Quran. He wrote a tafsir, a 40-volume tafsir. And how he could have done all this in 54 years is really quite stunning. But he wrote a 40-volume tafsir, Yaqut al-Ta'wil fi Tafsir al-Tanzil. And I heard that it's being published. I didn't even know it was available. But the Ihya, there's a critical edition of the Ihya that was done this year by Darul Fayha in Syria, which is a good edition. And there is another edition coming out this month, by Darul Minhaj in Jeddah, 9 volumes, incredible work, several years, looking at all the manuscripts, giving all the different riwayats, excellent tashkil of the difficult words and things. So for those of you who know Arabic, the book is going to really be available in a critical edition. And inshallah, we'll benefit from this time. It's a great place to be. Really take advantage of the incredible environment that we're in. And Uluda is a great mountain. I mean, that's what it means, great mountain. And there's really, I just feel this place is a really blessed place. And for those of you who have not prayed in that mosque down there, I'd really recommend going down there. That is a really incredible, lot of sakina in that little masjid down the road. It's open too, and there is a woman's section in there if there's nobody in there. So there is a woman's section in there. And what time is it now? Yeah. So subhanak allahumma wa bihamdika ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Jazakumullahu khairan.